outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Wayne, there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Ooh, what tunnel?
We have been living in Sheridan in sub-freezing temperatures for the last four straight weeks.
Sub-zero.
Sub-freezing.
Sub-freezing.
Okay. And then, well, for our Celsius people, then yes, sub-zero.
Centigrade, below zero.
For our Fahrenheit individuals, below freezing. But, and a lot of that time has been spent in either zero or negative weather. And yet we have 50 degrees forecasted on the horizon, and I am starting to celebrate. I'm holding on. I've got two more days.
So global warming finally makes its way to Wyoming, huh?
It's trying. Hopefully Southern California will share a little bit of its love and send some warmth our way.
Well, we're going to get up to the 70s this week, so that'll be good.
Oh, I will have to say that is one of the big things that I do miss about Southern California is the ability to pretty much be outdoors year round anytime you want to be.
Yeah, we've been suffering through the 60s, so we're kind of excited about getting up to the...
Oh, good. I'm glad you guys are going to thaw out there in Southern California.
Yeah, that'll be great. The mornings have been cool, though. Sarah and I have been walking out there with frost on the grass, so...
Ooh, okay, okay.
A little bit of that kind of temperatures.
Ah, all right. Well, you've seen a little bit of the cold then. Okay.
Yeah.
So Wayne, how are the walks going? I know that you've been doing physical therapy. I know that there's been some buildup. You're not wearing your back. You haven't been wearing your back brace for a little while now. Mm-hmm. What is the buildup process? Just a quick circle back to or update on health stuff over the last few weeks.
Yeah. Well, last week I skipped my chemo for the first time since we went to every other week. So that means I got to go tomorrow and get poked a bit.
Okay.
Happy about that. The walks are going pretty well. I got three miles in. Okay. I'm end up walking Mandy. It's been too hard on Sarah's shoulder. So I've got to be really careful with Mandy, who tends to get excited by some things and pull on the leash, which is not good for my back. So fortunately, Mandy is learning how to stay inside the slack in the rope, so to speak. So.
Okay.
But she does blow it now and then and makes my back a little bit sore, but.
Ooh, yeah. Okay.
But other than that, yeah, it's going great. Health-wise, yeah, feeling pretty good most days. Don't have a lot of side effects from what's going on. So really, really blessed and excited.
Numbers still looking good as far as the chemo goes?
Yeah, looking great. Looks like we're almost in remission probably by March. So thing about cutting back to once a month there. I still get email from people going, I know you're suffering and I know you're really hurting. And I'm going, no, I'm really not. I'm actually doing as well as I've always done. I've got aches and pains of being the age I am, but no, overall doing great and being able to get some stuff done.
Okay. All right.
Really missing the travel though. Just the interactions with people. I don't miss the airplanes and airports and all that stuff, but some engagement with people. And Sarah and I booked a cruise to Alaska this spring to celebrate our 50th anniversary. So
I was wondering what you were going to do for your 50th.
We're going to see how well I can negotiate a trip.
Ah, okay. How many days have you done cruises before? Like, is this a new thing for you?
We've done one cruise before. We did the family for our anniversary on our, it wasn't our 50th anniversary, it was our 40th, I guess. We took all the kids and grandkids and went off to the Mediterranean.
That's right. I remember that.
We didn't. Okay. Sarah and I are not real cruisers, not real nuts about that lifestyle and the way people get into it. But we're looking forward to this trip and seeing a little of Alaska and then kind of coming back down the coastline in the cruise ship. So,
okay. I've heard those Alaskan cruises are absolutely spectacular.
That's what people say. So
that's one that I think I'm very adverse to cruises, but I think that would be one that my wife could twist my arm into doing. So,
well, come join us. It'll be after your school year's out.
Oh, we'll talk about that open invitation later.
Watch all the email I get. We'll come. We'll go with you.
Yeah, we're gonna book. We're gonna have to book the whole cruise ship.
Fortunately, I'm announcing it now when the ship's almost full. Oh, I thought about doing a God Journey cruise or something, but I'm not sure we'd get enough people to make that financially viable with the cruise line. But
that would be interesting. Okay.
It would be. In any case, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And you found your way to the God Journey. And this is toward the end of February. So the year marches on. My goodness.
It is moving forward very, very quickly. And officially, you have a new book out, correct?
I do. As of today, officially, but it actually released yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a little different for me. We're not printing up books and shipping them and all. We're just going through ebook and then print on demand through Amazon.
Okay.
Eventually have it up on other ebook places as soon as we can work with our aggregator to get that solved. We've got a few hitches in the process, but yeah, it should be out there. Should be pretty available. It's interesting because all of the chapters have already appeared on my blog. So in Rough Draft, I did a little more cultivating the prose in working it for publication, but really happy with the piece, the cover art, the art inside. It's a beautiful little book.
It is. For those who have not been following the blog, what would be the elevator speech of what the heart is behind this book? What was your goal when you were starting to write this and you were exploring this? What was the heart behind the book?
Yeah, hopefully it was God's kind of leading, because I resisted doing this book, but the germ of it began in my heart almost 4 years ago when we were up in the Sierra Nevadas after a huge wildfire destroyed a bunch of that area, and just had this sense sitting in the whole devastation of the forest, it's time. And it took me a couple of days to process time for what, and landed on Romans 8. It's time for the sons and daughters of God to be revealed, that the creation yearns in eager expectation for that revelation. And the passion behind the book is, what if Jesus is coming in the next 12 to 15 years? And what does that look like in terms of us as followers of Christ and how we take on his character and light and life in the world? And how does that, because there's so many people who claim to know God, who demonstrate by their life that they may know him, but not so well. This has been a book to really help people discover, how do I get on a journey with God that's transformative, and that I it's not me for him, it's him in me. And how does that happen? And whether he's coming in the next dozen years or 150 years, it would still be worth living that way.
So this is not the prequel to the Left Behind series. That's what you're saying?
For sure, it's not that. Or even the sequel to it, since that didn't turn out to work out the way they prophesied that it would. This is less about dates and times and Antichrist and marks of the beast and all that kind of stuff. This is really about what it would take for a believer to live in those days. And I'm not a pre-trib guy, not saying Jesus is going to rescue all us Christians out before any of that stuff gets bad. But we'll live through some very desperate times, those of us who are alive at that point. So I'm writing this book kind of out of my life journey and life lessons. And what is it? What would it take if I were being asked? That's how I finally cleared my way to do this book. If I was with a weekend of young kids and they asked me, could you come and talk to us about what you would think would be important for us to know as the age ends? And I thought, I can write that book. It's not the definitive work. It's not the only voice out there, but it is a voice to say, this is really about how we live inside of Jesus and trust his heart, and then able to endure whatever circumstances may come our way because he's with us.
So when you're thinking about that, why were you initially resistant to write it? What was it? What caused the hesitation or the pause to write this?
Because I used to be a last days guy. I mean, Jordeldon Ladd, when I was back in university days 50 years ago, I was kind of into trying to sort all that out. And for the last 30, 40 years, I've not even been curious about it. So it's been something I've kind of shedded. And then after that little moment of it's time, and that's grown in my heart, I just felt like God said, would you write a book like that? And just felt like that, he put that on my heart. And I was really thinking, who am I to write a book like that? And I don't really want to. And I'd rather, there's two or three other projects on my heart I'd rather get to first. But he finally won me into the space of, yeah, I this is a book that needs to be written. And, he even asked me one day, I was really wrestling with God about this, and I just felt like he nudged me on a walk, just, well, then who else would you have me to write it? And a bunch of names came to mind, and for reasons I could say, yeah, no, not them. No, not her. No, 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 not that. No, not that. And then it really was down to, I'd really want to get my perspective out there about this, that I think is what God wants to share.
So how would you say the perspective and the things that God has been in conversation with you about over the last 40 years, how does it align with some of the other conversations that are out there? And how does it potentially diverge from some of the conversations that are out there in regards to the last days?
Yeah, because it's not political and it's not trying to wrestle through geopolitics and try to find the scriptural matching for what scripture is talking about at any given point. I'm really convinced that Jesus said, look, I'm telling you these things so when they happen, you'll know. He didn't say, I'm telling you these things so you can figure it all out before it gets here. I think what Jesus is asking of us is the kind of trust in him that can endure whatever comes our way, even if it's back surgery and cancer out of the blue, and it could be persecution in the future. There are already people all over the world under persecution for faith. So it wouldn't be like, oh, this would be brand new, that people would endure that. What kind of resilience would it take in a relationship with God that could withstand whatever comes our way? And I think that's as applicable to the challenges of living in the 21st century as it would be to face the end of the age and what would compound there. But there's so many, and I have a sneaking suspicion we're closer to his return than most people think, that there's just a number of factors in our society that line up to, and I don't mean the geopolitical stuff, I mean the amount of rancor and discord, the amount of anger, the amount of looking for a redeemer, all those things portend the Antichrist, portend somebody that can offer the solutions that people are seeking. And in our world, it's gotten much more risky the last 10, 15 years, I guess. And the ways we could destroy ourselves, which we didn't even have the power to annihilate humanity until 1946. And now we do in a variety of ways, whether it's a virus out of a lab or a nuclear war or just economic meltdown or whatever. These are dangerous times. And I'm not a prophet of doom. I want to say to people, hey, look, God's got this in hand. And he wants us to be the kind of followers that are able to walk through whatever comes our way with him, and have enough of our life in him and living loved and being secure in his love that we're actually living differently than the rest of the world lives around us. We're not motivated by the same success needs, greed needs, inferiority needs, all those kinds of things. That we really do have a security in him that allows us to put the needs of the other alongside of our own, so that we live in a world not just aware of me and what I want and me getting my part, but me living alongside other people, not just tribally, not people of my own ilk, but live in the world as lights in a dark place, as grace that can be extended to people who are looking for a rescue.
I'm really intrigued because I don't know if you and I've ever even talked about this. What is your thoughts, feedback on Revelation and on some of the different predictions that there's been in regards to the end times, in regards to some of the suffering or some of the geopolitical things? Or because I hear a lot of the conversation about what's going on in the Middle East and what's going on in some of the other parts of the world and the rumors of wars and wars, right? And I do think that there's a lot of just the pain and the turmoil and the desperation for a connection with the authentic love of Father. In my lifetime, I have never sensed a greater need for it or a greater desire for it in our world. What are your thoughts in regards to Revelation and some of the things that people are saying in regards to what could happen during the end times?
Yeah. And again, my book isn't about it. And I don't think my mindset is about trying to figure out how this works out geopolitically.
Okay.
My heart is the book of Revelation really encourages people to live deeply inside of God, to know his goodness, to have an authentic faith and an authentic love in him. And that kind of sets up in the first three chapters as to where the church had gone sideways in various places. So Jesus confronts that. But also as it goes through the book, we don't know how all these, what the mark of the beast will look like or who the Antichrist will be or any of those things. But we do know that there'll be a challenge of faith, that faith will become a very dangerous, subversive way to live at the end of the age. And yet Jesus is with his people and can encourage us in a way. And I think that subversion doesn't come because we're trying to undermine the political landscape we're in. I think that subversion is because we live out of love instead of living in the self-protection that the flesh invites us into. And the encouragement is, and I think there are symbols of things in Revelation, like when you get to Babylon, and Babylon is destroyed, and this city that has exported its harlotries over the whole world. In our day, if that isn't the United States, I don't know who it would be. Just not only because of the excess of our world, but the fact that we literally, through movies, export our debauchery to the rest of the world. Yeah. And it's all about whatever it takes to entice people to make a buck. And the bottom, the profit line, and that all goes away in Revelation. That all goes away in a day. And the kings of the world lament, which we don't have many kings in the world today, but the leaders of the world lament because they were making money off of all that too. And so this huge economic crash by a major power, that's something I've got my eye on. I got my eye on three conflicts in the world that could easily become world wars, whether it's the Ukraine thing, the Middle East thing, or even our tension with China and shipping lanes and who owns what land and Taiwan. And there's three things in our world that could grow to be national or international wars. And so I've got my eye on all that. I've got my eye on the fact that climate change is such that it's causing havoc everywhere in the world, from fires to floods to whatever. And we had that in Kentucky this week, huge floods there. Well, we're having fires out here. The hurricane devastation in Florida. You even had a tornado in Oxnard last week during the storm. So there's things in the weather that's going on. It's got my attention. There's things, earthquakes and things going on. It's got my attention. And all those things just invite me closer to Jesus, saying, Jesus, I just want to be with you. I don't care how this unfolds, what you need me to be a part of and all that, but I want to be a reflection of your glory in the world in which I live. And I want to help other people find that too.
And you talk about a resilient faith that's strengthened in the midst of adversity. So these adverse conditions, these adverse life experiences. I just got done reading for my first go around, The Anxious Generation. And it was phenomenal. It was a phenomenal read. But one of the things that it's talking about and really highlighting is that our current generation, Gen Z, that is coming to college, that's currently in high school, etc., they are known by sociologists as the least resilient generation in recorded history. So when you're looking at the end of days, if it is time, and then all of a sudden you have a generation, one of the more influential generations coming up right now, and yet they're also being described as the least resilient generation in recorded history. Where do we go from there?
I don't know. Hopefully that's in God's portfolio somewhere. He knows what to do. But I honestly believe when I talk about the sons and daughters of God to be revealed, that creation is anxious for that. I don't think this is something God's going to start doing with my book. I think it's something God's already been doing all over the world. I meet people with a resilience of faith and a resilience of trust, who've been through the most desperate of circumstances and have come out on the other side with an ever-deepening trust in who God is, that I know God has already salted the world with people like that everywhere. And whatever younger generation, I think desperation and need may well drive them to a place to seek more eternal answers than they're already seeking to date. And I think there's a fresh wave of the Spirit's drawing to Jesus. I already see some of these things. I see the first fruits of all these things already, that there's a hunger among young people, that there is some things that I think God has arranged in such a way that he's got all this in place. So he's got people seated all over the world who already know him and know how to walk through adversity with him. They'll have access to people near them who are hungering for a different way of different living. I think the book now in publishing its time at the moment. I hope it spurs some other people that are in the purview of my listening or reading audience to be able to go, okay, I want to be one of those too. I don't want to just get by in life and get my job and get my marriage and just deal. I want to be ready inside my heart for whatever comes. And that can be flying home from a trip and finding your wife gone. That can be finding out you have cancer, laying in an emergency ward in a hospital thinking it's kidney stones. It's amazing what faith can take you through if you find yourself having the capacity to hold space with Jesus until you know what's going on. Because resilience is not, my faith is strong enough, it can handle anything. Our faith gets challenged, it gets knocked in the teeth. Resilience is, it's able to rise, that the trust in Jesus is able to rise above the challenge that's coming my way. And that's what I want people to know. And I don't want it to be that to be an abstract reality. I want to know Jesus is inside this with me. And Jesus has the tools, the leadership, the direction, the demeanor to shape my heart so that this thing that challenges me isn't going to derail me or destroy me. It's actually going to invite me deeper into who he is. And so that every trial we have now, was it Hebrews 12 says, endure all hardship as discipline. It's not saying it is. But whenever I encounter hardship and doubts and fears and challenges bigger than my trust level in Jesus, this is the training ground for me to go, okay, I want to learn now how to trust him. I want to learn now how to really look to him and not go down that road of, well, God doesn't love me and I know he doesn't care about me because he didn't do what I thought he should do. It really is time for us to step back and say, okay, Jesus, show yourself here. How are you in this with me? Not, why did this happen to me? Jesus, why didn't you stop this? Why didn't you prevent? But how, Jesus, do you want to help me navigate this space? And that's what Sarah and I are doing with her trauma, with my cancer, with the challenges that we didn't have or didn't know we had 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and now we have. And yet in that, we're finding Jesus to be incredibly resilient. And our capacity to lean into that space where he is and then walk with him through what comes and do that with a sense of joy. I mean, there's a lot about our life, Sarah and mine, that has changed in the last 4 years. And yet his grace is still present with us in those things. And so our golden years may not look like we thought they were going to look like. But as one person said, they learned from their grandma, and I love this, find a different way to be happy. Whenever mom said no and disappointed the child, and the child would get all whiny and frustrated, the grandma would look at her and just say, find another way to be happy. And I think that's, happy is not just, it sounds pretty weak, but find another way to joy. It may not be what you thought, but he's still in it. There's a greater, and I think probably this is the greatest calling, I think, for all of us from the book. It's not about just me and my life. It's about the God's plan of redemption for the whole world and how he winds up this age, whether it's in our lifetime or in the next few decades. I have no idea. But having a perspective that this is all bigger than me. And it's even bigger than America or Russia or Ukraine or whatever. This is God's plan of redemption, maybe unfolding in our lifetime, the final chapter of it. And if so, yeah, there's challenges to face, but there's also real excitement about, man, I can't wait to see how he winds this up.
And the idea of how God is going to reveal the sons and daughters, right? Like I've always really resonated with that. And the other piece you talked about, living out of love, living out of the life of Christ is going to be dangerous. And I love that you said that because for me, growing up, I did not see the life of Christ as being dangerous. I thought the life of Christ spelled doormat, a very nice doormat that was nice and fluffy and would not scratch your feet by any means. And yet, as the longer that I've lived and walked with Father, the more that I see that as you live out of his love, it is disruptive. As you allow your life to be a conduit of his kingdom and his love and his power to move in the world, it is dangerous to the systems that man has created. It's dangerous to my own presumptions and my ways of getting through life. It's dangerous for my survival mechanisms. It's dangerous for some of the, one of the things that you talk about in the book is love stronger than their own self-interest, right? That it's that shift of, okay, I'm actually living for something bigger than myself. And it's a love that can absolutely rock to the core the foundations and the plans and the schemes of man.
Yeah, it's just even the political thing that we're seeing in America these days, the whole Trump agenda of America first. And that sounds, if you're an American, that sounds like really good. We've been doing too much in the world to help other people at our own cost or expense. But imagine any individual walking in a room saying, hey, it's about Wayne first. And navigates the room with that way. My needs, what I want, you're all here to serve me. I think that's how it's coming off to the rest of the world. The most selfish person in the world who has most of the world's goods to begin with, and now you're going to go into a me first agenda. And I think that's what the world's used to from us as individuals. Get off the geopolitical plane, get it down to where you live in your neighborhood with the people. They're used to people who are all about themselves, doing whatever's best for them, and without ignoring people who are different from them. Or maybe they have love, but their love is tribal. Their life, love goes to people who look and act like them. And so when you have people who live with an others-focused mentality, whose love's not just for the home team, it's for the away team too, and to speak up for justice where justice is being abrogated, that will become subversive. I think love at its deepest, I don't mean just good feelings, mamby-pamby, hug and sing kumbaya, but I mean the real depth of looking out for other people and caring about them. That is subversive in a world that plans on you being selfish, because that's how most other people around them are. So they're guarded, they're on hyper alert, because selfishness is the way most people live. And to talk about someone that would be in that world unselfishly, loved enough by God that they don't have to guard themselves. They can really look out for other people, which is what, you know, Paul encourages to. And there's that whole thing in the Gospels of Paul saying, man, let your life reflect the glory of the Lord in the world. And I don't think most people know how to do that. The chapter I'm working on now is the God-shaped life. It's not a Wayne-shaped life for God. It's God taking shape inside Wayne and learning what that process looks like so we can cooperate with it. Because, my goodness, God doesn't want us in the world as actors that we're acting loving or we're acting unselfishly. He wants people in the world that are genuinely that way without thinking. So they're living to a different drummer. They're marching to a different beat. And that will be engaging in the world. I think primarily that's how God wants to reveal himself and wants to reveal these sons and daughters of God, because they live differently in the world.
And that, I think, is the piece that when I am in conversations with people, and it spans generation, it spans age demographic, but just this deep longing desire to live for something meaningful in the world that's bigger than themselves, like that, just being tired with the message of, oh, be egocentric. It is all about you. Just the overplay of that, and then how that's manipulated for the gains of marketing or government or whatever it might be.
Market share, audience number. Yeah.
Whatever. Oh my gosh. Yes. And so to have this deep longing for, okay, I don't want it to be, if it's all about me, that feels good for a little while. But then it starts to taste really sour and starts to turn my stomach a little bit, because if it's all about me, then what about everybody else in the world around me? Because if everybody's agenda is egocentric, then it's going to be an incredibly lonely, very quickly self-destructive world.
And it is. I mean, we see that's already true in so many ways. If people are out to get their share, they don't care about other people, and whoever they've got to manipulate or use to get what they want, they're willing to do that. And people are used to that. And when they come up against somebody who's living differently, who's lives an others-focused lifestyle, it's not about me anymore. God's got my back. God's taking care of me, so I don't have to worry about that. My life can be, now, how do I help those around me? How do I care for them? How do I open a door to relationship, open a door to light. And it's not some kind of frenzied activity. That's what I love yeah. about this. It's just simply a different way of being in the world that God produces in people who walk with him. And you can't act it out. You can't give, you know, five attributes and say, let's all pretend to be this way, because it's not a pretense kind of thing. It's got to come from the core of your heart. You mentioned earlier the people whose love is larger than their own self-interest. That's always fascinated me. People I know who've made decisions against their own self-interest because God put it on their heart to do so. Those are always the people that fascinate me. Because you understand why people do what's in their best interest. You understand that. Yeah. But yeah. you don't understand people who, well, you did what? Why did you do that? I just felt like I needed to. And you go, what was that? Whether it was conscience or whether it was demonstratively God, they would say, God led me to do this. But they're so healthy on the inside that they don't have to serve their interests, and they're willing to trust God beyond that. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Well, it's even that understanding that if it's shifting that perspective again from a self individual focus to a us focus of, if I'm doing well and I can celebrate that, awesome. But if other people are doing well, that doesn't diminish me. That doesn't take away from me. That doesn't threaten me. I can celebrate and be encouraged by this other expression of this person living out more of who God's created them to be in the world. That's not a threat to my identity, my sense of self, or my own well-being. But when we live in that fear-based, individualistic, scarcity mentality, then all of a sudden it's like, oh no, I've got to mow that person over so that they are not a beacon in the world, or that their wholeheartedness in the world is a threat to me.
Yeah, it's a difference between being competitive and being collaborative. You know, yeah. being competitive is everybody's out to get their share, and if I'm not going to get mine because they've got more than they need, or all the anxiety of all of that. Can you imagine just being free of that anxiety and being able to say, okay, God is with me and he's able to lead and guide me, and whatever he wants to provide for me, he can and will. And I'm just his servant in the world, just following him and being able to love people genuinely from the heart, putting their needs above my own, because that's the way he works. That's what he invited us into. And that's, I think that causes people, even we've noticed some on the neighborhood, when you just you take an interest and you care, and some people are like, what do you want from me? And then when they find out there isn't an agenda behind that, I'm not trying to sell them a book or a podcast or anything like that. I'm just taking an interest in my neighbors, that opens up the kinds of relationships that Sarah and I are really enjoying after only a couple of years of living in the area. And it's remarkable. It's obvious when somebody comes into a room and in the conversation that's going on, it's all about them and what they're doing, and they draw all attention to themselves. My precious. And people, you can see it. People get a little annoyed with it, and they kind of, oh man, this guy's dominating the whole afternoon. Instead of just being a part and collaborating with the people that God's put around you.
And yet I think that's one of the powerful characteristics of living this out, is it feels weird. It feels off to people because the natural assumption is, oh, they are out for themselves. They are out to get their own gain. There's got to be an agenda here. What is, you know, I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? And so it feels off-putting to encounter a genuine person who's like, no, there's no agenda here. I'm just excited to meet you, or I'm curious about who you are, or I would love to hear more about your story, or, you know, those different pieces. Our threat meter doesn't know what to do with that. It's like, oh, okay, what just happened there? I'm not sure how to categorize this one. And is this an actual threat? Should I be threatened? I don't know. Like, part of me is saying I shouldn't be, but part of me is like, that I haven't ever seen that register before.
And let them find out in time. I mean, I don't tell people I got nothing to sell you. They're going to know it by the way you live over time. And it's not going to be any one conversation or any one thing that you say or deny or whatever. It's just being able to be a genuine person living alongside Jesus in the world and letting that light shine out. And my heart is hungry that the genuine sons and daughters of God would be revealed in the earth, because the imposter sons and daughters of God are mucking with God's character every way but Tuesday. and making it look like, gosh, God doesn't know what he's doing because his followers are as creepy as they can possibly be. And how is it that we can reflect the same life that Jesus reflected into the world, whether it was tax collectors or sinners or religious leaders or his own followers or Mary and Martha and Gal? He knew how to just be with people in a way that was loving. And when they were interested in the light, he could dispense some light and invite them to something deeper.
To me, I just feel like this space is so needed, and yet working through unsorting it, untangling. I've always loved that imagery of the untangling of the life of Christ, specifically from the brand of Christianity. And yet, even then, I feel like God is doing that. Like everywhere you say, we talk about the people mucking up the life of Christ with the brand of Christianity. And yet, as I look around, I don't see the brand doing very well. I feel like even that it's been being unveiled for whether it is real and authentic and true, or if it is self-centered and disingenuine and manipulative. And it's being revealed. It's being the authentic is being left behind, and the chaff is getting burnt up pretty hard, it feels like to me.
Yeah, I think the things I try and describe in the book, I don't think this book begins those things, as I said. I think these things are already going on in the world.
Yeah.
And I'm excited by that. I mean, the email I've gotten from most people as the chapters have kind of unfolded online over the last year and a half or so are people who are saying, man, this is the most encouraging thing I've ever read. I don't know. I cut the end of every chapter and I'm so excited about what God's going to do, even though we're talking about some pretty desperate circumstances that might come. I'm really pleased that what people are capturing from the book is, oh my gosh, God's big enough to get us through this. God's big enough. And that the bride who's waiting for Christ to come, the subtitle of the book is Letters to the Bride of Christ at the End of the Age, that the anticipation of the bride is the wedding day is coming. My groom is coming. There may be some rough moments getting through to all that, but the overall joy is not terrorized and fear because Jesus is coming back to the planet, but the wedding day has arrived and we get to be united with our husband, and the thrill of all of that, to me, that's the joy of the book of Revelation or whatever else, is it leads to this great marriage supper of the Lamb, and it leads to the final fulfillment of everything we've ever desired that's been disappointed in this world in terms of our spiritual hungers. Those things get to come to full fruition at the end of the age. And so rather than fear it, which I was taught to do when I was young, anything had to do with the second coming and the Antichrist and 666 and blah, 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 it just provoked fear because, man, we're going to have to withstand all that by ourselves instead of, no, this is the groom's approach to the bride. This is him standing at the threshold of human history saying, I'm ready to resolve it. I'm ready to judge. And I mean judge by setting things right that are so destructive and difficult because of the way humanity has selfishly exploited himself, each other, and the planet. Now, finally, what God had in mind from the beginning is about to unfold. And I think that's the most exciting thing in the world.
So where is part two going?
Part one is kind of setting up the whole thing. Part two is more to what we even talked about a couple of years ago, the God-shaped life, how God shapes a sincere love, a resilient trust, how he does this and he can respond to him, and then how we hold space with him toward the end of the age, how we carry the pain that God carries for the brokenness of the world, how we love the way he loves in the world. And so it's the first part is more, how would we think about these events and our place in them and the connection with God that we have? And now the second part is, how does that connection take expression through us? Because I still want people to think, even though I'm writing the God-shaped life, part of what I'm saying is, the first thing God does when he comes to rescue you is not to make you a demonstration of his glory in the world. He wants to rescue you from every place where sin and trauma and pain has warped your life. So it's not for people, hey, let's get on, let's be the demonstration of God and get into all that stuff. No, let's be healed first. Let's find him in a way that reconciles the twisted places of my life. As that happens, the transformation will be going on internally, that you'll be able to step into a different way of living as you're liberated from those things that got twisted. And so it's still about rescue and redemption. And then hopefully we get to a place where we can be part of the rescuing and the redemption as well. So that's the second part of the whole thing, is how we demonstrate that glory in the world and then are able to introduce other people to the reality of who Jesus is, not to becoming Christians or becoming, I think the whole idea, and we got to it, an it of a religion instead of he is a person, that we made a departure from something way more real. I was reading something today that kind of took faith and depersonalized again. The faith of Jesus is the faith in the religion Jesus taught. Instead of, no, it's trust in who he is and how he wants to love us and engage us. And somehow we keep getting that, we keep getting the it ahead of the him, and everything goes bad from there.
One of the things that has stood out as, because as I've read through the blog, it's been a lot of the things that you and I have been exploring for a while, and that other people have been writing to us about, and that people that I'm having conversations with and you, people that you're having conversations with, are already highlighting it, that it's already happening. And one of the things to me that really is, I think, one of the attributes or characteristics of somebody walking is the pace. Because they, especially during COVID and some of the things, like just the urgency, the franticness, the lack of peace that was present.
Yep.
And yet there was people that I would encounter that the pace of their life was different. It was slower. It was relaxed. It was love, rest, and play. It had a different pace to it. That's the only way I can really say, like, come out to say to it. But especially in the perceived urgency, or we like living in a chaos culture where everything around us, like 24/7, there's something going on in the news cycle that is worse than it was the last 30 minutes ago. And gosh, like that's exhausting, and it's not very attractive.
For sure.
And yet when I bump into the people that are walking, still walking through the same thing, still walking through pain, still walking through challenge, still walking through trial, and yet the pace of the life is different, man, that is a blaring light in my mind as far as just highlighting what's going on, or putting a question mark into what's going on here.
Yeah, and that's engaging. When you find people who are on a journey with Jesus through whatever the world's throwing at them, whatever life throws at them, that's engaging. And I think that's the way, it's really time for those people to be revealed in the earth, that what may have been a lot of obscurity for a long time will become a bit more obvious as God puts his finger on those things. And as the world gets a bit darker, it needs people with enough trust, enough connection with Jesus, to not have to have all the answers and strut around pretending they've got it all figured out, but they're just gently loving those that God's put near them. And that will put more of his light in the world than anything else I can think of.
It makes me honestly think of a book that I read a while ago called In the Unseen. And it really highlighted that about, it's not the people that are in the spotlight, on the stage, the loud voices and the beacons. It's the people that have been quietly allowing the life of Christ to be cultivated in their heart in the unseen, not in some boisterous or magnified way, but as a product of genuine relationship.
And those people need encouragement, which I hope this book does. And a lot of this comes out of the prayer times I've been having with folks from around the world for the state of the world. So a lot of it rises out of that as well. So I'm excited. I'm excited to see how that material gets into the world and interact with it, with people.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.